Yeah, I heard the question.
Okay, good.
Okay. We're talking about dues. We have always had a policy of allowing anybody to, encouraging people to join the congregation, irrespective of their financial means. Is it not running?
Yeah, it's running. It's running. It's running. The volume. Okay, go.
So, our average dues have always been lower than our minimum dues. My guess is that at the present time, with 1,800 families or so as members, we probably have 500 families that are paying less, probably 300 of those families paying very little, just as a token that they want to participate in some way. But we've also never made sure that, first of all, nobody really knew. I have no idea what anybody's dues are, either on the high end or on the low end. And it also is not a criterion for any position of leadership. So, well, that's not entirely right. My guess is that at the senior board, people look at that. But there, too, there are some people who clearly have a very limited financial ability.
Walter, because we've talked about the junior congregation, could you tell us a little bit about Ken, your son? Kenny was president of the junior congregation.
Yes, Kenny eventually became president of the junior congregation and enjoyed that very much. And now that he's back in town, they've asked him to be back on the board, he'll do that. It's also a good way for young people discovering how to get other people to work, discovering that in some instances it's impossible to get other people to work, and you have to do it yourself.
That's part of being a leader.
Yes. Uh-huh. And the membership size has varied. So at its peak, there were probably 300, maybe even close to 400 members in the junior congregation. The normal number has been somewhere between 125 and 150, and they're either single or married. And the programming has also varied. Some years it's heavily social, and some years it's more intellectual and religious.
What year was he president?
I'd have to look that up.
Okay, all right.
It's about four or five years ago, and we are now in 1996.
Gabby, you wanted to ask something, and I wanted Walter to answer that question from the other side.
Well, we'll lose that time.
Okay. Is it okay?
Sure.
You mentioned Bart Cowan, who is now president.
Bart Cowan,
Bart Cowan, you mentioned him. Okay, then you talked about Frederick Schwartz, who was your assistant, a rabbi. And
we were assistants and associates together.
Okay, and then you talked also about your proposal to Dr.
Okay,
Levi.
Now, when I arrived here after the military, this is now 1957, Dr. Freehoff was, how old was he in 1957? He was in his mid-60s and felt that he needed some additional help with the congregation. And so we began to talk about having two people as assistants. So my suggestion was my classmate, Fred Schwartz, who had taken a... We were in the military together. He was in Japan. I visited him there. And we were in school together. He had taken a position as a Hillel director at the University of Florida. And I knew we could work together, and it's important if you have two people in that tandem position to be able to really hit it off and not have any problems. So that was was acceptable to Dr. Freehoff, so then we worked together. And it did prove very, very easy to do that, because we are very different people. I saw him in Chicago last week. He's now at the Senior Rabbi Temple Sholem on the North Shore in Chicago, which is a congregation just like this. We decided right from the beginning that we would essentially do everything together. And so neither one of us was assigned to something, and we did religious school and the auxiliaries and pastoral visits and preaching together. And as I mentioned on one of these tapes, that Dr. Freehoff's method was not to be terribly concerned about the daily running of the congregation, unless there was a matter of policy or unless there was some problem. So, you know, we'd go to a brotherhood board meeting or a sisterhood board meeting. The next day, at the beginning at least, try to tell Dr. Freehoff about what had gone on. But it was clear from after about 2 minutes of conversation that as long as nothing untoward had happened, there was no need to go further, and he was much more interested in pursuing something academic or some paper or so that he was working on or that we were working on. So we were given a pretty free hand in this regard, and completely so in the religious school.
Right, and you said you took turns. One went to sisterhood, one went to brotherhood. You mentioned that, and also you sort of.
We spelled each
the work
other,
and
easily interchanged.
You also mentioned,
and
Rabbi,
we were both working on doctorates at the time, and then finished within a year of each other, and finished that.
You mentioned Rabbi Edelstein at Temple David in Monroeville.
He arrived here. I don't remember exactly when, sometime in the late 50s or early 60s, to take the congregation Temple David, a very nice suburban congregation, which grew considerably under his leadership and developed into a nice building. Before that time, I should mention, I went out quite often to help them out on a Friday evening, because we didn't have a late Friday evening service, which was usually a bit of an adventure, because they were in a different place every time. So sometimes it was a church, sometimes, I remember once it was a room which I suppose normally was used as a nightclub, and there was a sort of a circular light that kept going around. And I also remember once somebody who was a carpenter in the congregation had built them an ark for a Torah, and this service was supposed to dedicate it. So I went out to dedicate it, and of course at the appropriate time was supposed to put the Torah into the ark. The gentleman had forgotten to measure the Torah, so it didn't fit into the ark. There wasn't anything you could do.
Okay, I'm sorry.
Jay Edelstein came from the military from Hawaii, and I think I also mentioned the first time we were together. Eva and Jay and Irene and I. Irene had baked, unfortunately, a pineapple cake, and that was the wrong thing.
They'd had enough of them, huh?
Yes, but we got to be very good friends. Again, quite different in our approach to things and as personalities, but saw each other all through the years on a fairly regular basis.
Okay, Walter, I'm going to sort of, because we're trying to repeat the tape that we lost, I'm going to sort of, and if you don't mind this, Gabby, you mentioned that Dr. Fred Schwartz was here from 1958 to 1966.
Mm-hmm.
That Dr. Freehoff retired, and that you and Dr. Schwartz had suggested to him that maybe, or to the congregation, that the two of you would co?
Well, it's a little more complex than that.
Okay.
After being here for 10 years, Fred for 8, and everything had gone very well with us, we both decided that we didn't want to stay as we'd been named associates, but we did not want to stay as associate rabbis forever. And so we decided that we would both start looking for positions of our own, and announced that to Dr. Freehoff. And after thinking about that a little bit, he announced that in that case he would retire, because he did not want to, now in his 70s, to be bothered with two new young assistants whom he had to deal with. He had been absent a lot during those years because he was president of the World Union, and anyhow did a lot of speaking around the country. He was always here on Sunday, sat on the weekends, but was frequently gone, not entirely, but quite often gone during the week. We talk about Stanley Levin on this tape or on a previous tape?
Oh, yes, yes, we did. I don't know. We've talked about Stanley, yes.
Yes.
Definitely. We talked about him extensively. Where it is, I don't know. We'll get to it if that's on this tape.
Okay. Okay. So what happened then was that the two of us decided we would both, the first thing we decided was we would talk to the board, or to the president, certainly Lester Aaron, about possibly having a co-rabbinate, because we got along so well, and I think it would have worked for that reason. However, the history of co-rabbinates generally is poor, and usually ends up as a disaster. So they were not inclined to go in that direction. So Fred then took a position in St. Paul, and I decided to pursue matters here. And
had support from Lester Aaron.
Well, it took a little more than that, but that certainly was crucial.
And I think it's very appropriate now then, because it's part of the notes, that you would then describe the procedure that...
Well, the procedure was that there was a clear division, both on the board and I'm sure also among a fair number of congregants, as to how to proceed. And this was, you might say, an introduction to politics, which I largely avoided beforehand and also subsequently. But there were people who were interested in my becoming the rabbi of the congregation, and so they proceeded to do much of the whatever contacting and so on was necessary. The junior congregation and the brotherhood and the sisterhood were for that. A fair number of the older people were not. And in retrospect, it's even more understandable than it might have been in prospect, partly because what they were looking for was somebody who would do pretty much what Solomon B. Freehoff had done, which was be a first-class orator spend a lot of time on that part of congregational life. Matters went as far as the selection committee, I guess, or part of the board, finding someone and bringing that individual down to Pittsburgh. I had a dinner with him at the Concordia Club and felt that he might very well be appropriate. And this colleague then the next day came to see me and asked me, you know, what my thoughts were. Well, I told him what my thoughts were. And then he asked me if, in case he was elected as senior rabbi, would I be willing to stay on as his associate because he would want me to stay on as his associate. And I simply said to him, it will not come to that. After saying that forcefully a fair number of times, he decided that he would not have his name presented until this whole matter was cleared up, and what really was my status in the future. There were, I'm sure, plenty of debates, of which I heard echoes, you might say, because I was never present at the board meeting, had no seat on the board. Eventually was proposed by the Board of Trustees to the congregation, which is the method. And this looked like it was going to be a stormy session. So ballots were prepared. Parliamentarian, I believe, was engaged. There was a big congregational meeting with some people spoke for me and other people spoke against me.
And you were there?
Oh, no, I wasn't there.
Okay.
No, I wasn't there. I wasn't anywhere near there. I was at home. I don't know what the vote was, but it was rather strongly in my favor. So became elected as senior rabbi. The whole process took about a year. So it was a long, long, drawn-out matter. And of course, you know, during all of this, one had to keep doing everything else, more or less as if nothing was happening, make sure that everybody was treated fairly, including people who you knew were opposed to you, not let that interfere.
Was that very hard for you?
No, that was all right. So there were some funny incidents. For example, one of the individuals who really did not want me as senior rabbi, once the board had voted on this, asked me to come to his office, which I did, and said, if I will withdraw my opposition, if you will simply be elected for 1 year, and then after that we'll vote on you again. But I said to him, no, that simply isn't going to work, because having gone through 1 year of this, I didn't want to go through another year of, so to speak, trying to work on this. People who were very helpful in all of this were Stanley Levin, the principal of the religious school, who had a lot of good advice and a lot of good insight and also was very supportive. Lucille Wedner, who was the president of the sisterhood at that time, also was extremely helpful. Al Raisman, who was president of the Brotherhood at that point, to a lesser extent, Marvin Joseph, and some other people as well. And of course, a principal, as far as being helpful, not in an active way, but in a passive way, was Irene, because it certainly would have been a much easier year to take a congregation somewhere else and not to go through this whole turmoil for a year in which you had to more or less ignore what was happening and what people were saying and pretend nothing was going on.
She supported you.
Oh, yes.
And yeah. Dr. Freehoff, was he actively involved at all? Or?
No, Dr. Freehoff was completely neutral.
How did that feel?
Well, it felt kind of awkward. So we never talked about this. We just talked about other things. At the very end, when it had been completely decided, by the board, he dictated a letter which indicated that, you know, we ought to have a peaceful congregation, a peaceful succession, and should move ahead. That went out. Actually, after it had gone out, he had some second thoughts about it, but by that time it had already gone out. But
what were his second thoughts?
Well, maybe he shouldn't do that either and stay out of it completely. But one has to see this in the broader context of his nature. His nature was never to get involved in a controversy. And if possible, to make peace, and otherwise to stay out of it completely.
But do you agree with him?
No. I have gotten myself involved in controversy. And in the case of Mark's statement, have done my best to see to it that, first of all, he had support on the board, and that people who would support him would be nominated to the board, and that and supported him at the congregational meeting. So, you know, it's a different approach. That's all. But that never led to any, you know, any bad feeling between Dr. Friedhoff and me. We simply pretended that nothing was happening proceeded on. But Lester Aaron really was a person who was key to, you might say, to all of this. In retrospect, you know, becoming senior rabbi of this large congregation and succeeding one of the most prominent people in the Reform movement at age 36 was a kind of it was perhaps a little bit of chutzpah, you might say.
And did you have reservations or?
I had no reservations. Otherwise, I would never have done it.
Okay.
And what was interesting to me was that at the day after this was decided, I must have gotten several hundred phone calls from colleagues around the country and also from people in the congregation. I really spent maybe 3 days almost entirely on the telephone.
Mm-hmm. Well,
it was interesting, and it was a good lesson, but it was also a good lesson in not letting these sorts of things interfere. So, you know, the next week, a little later, when nothing had changed on the board, I mean, everybody, pro and con, was on the board, we worked together in complete harmony and never talked about any of this, and I made it a point never to read any minutes, and that's past.
You kept it very constructive. Well, I was a supporter of yours, and I'm glad I was. You talked about your installation, Walter, how you were installed, and that your father installed you, and that there was a bishop.
Well, as it turned out, the bishop couldn't come, so a priest, I should remember his name, but I don't, who was designated by him, one of the Monsignors, came, and for the Jewish community, the Rabbinic Fellowship, Rabbi Landis came. And you reminded me of what the priest had said, because it may have been McDowell. I'm not 100% sure, because McDowell later became bishop, and we were good friends. Okay, so he said
he knew about the generation.
Well, my father, I think, mentioned that.
Right. How many generations of rabbis?
This was 16 generations.
Right.
So he said, "I am the first, and I'm the last."
He brought the house down. He really did. It was marvelous.
He is a he remains Bishop of Pittsburgh, one of the auxiliary bishops, a very able man who did a tremendous amount for the educational system, in this, the Catholic educational system, and then was very much involved in civil rights and a good many other things too. So we worked together and got to know each other over the years. That was also true of another bishop, who is Bishop of Greensburg, Bosco, Anthony Bosco, whom I got to know when we were both young, and we went once to Bethany College on a sort of an interfaith assignment. Spent several days there talking about all kinds of things, and then ended up together quite frequently in dialogue sessions. The one I remember best was a dialogue at a radio station. And at that point, he was a heavy smoker of cigars. And we were in this broadcast booth, and he was smoking cigars, and I think almost died before the dialogue was over.
Could barely see you, huh? Your father installed you.
Yes. And of course, Dr. Frioff took part in that too. It was a very nice service. One of my friends, who had one of these tiny cameras, a Minox, which is no bigger than a finger, even took some pictures of that. Now, that service was recorded on a big round tape. But again, I've not listened to it again. So.
You then talked about book reviews. That the first year after Dr. Frioff resigned, you chose not to have book reviews.
Yes. Now, there was a problem with following Dr. Frioff, because I certainly was not going to match his oratory or his style of preaching. So it was a matter of what do you continue and what don't you. And the book reviews had been so much associated with him, and he liked to do them so much. It started off, I think, with 12 in the late 30s, eventually wound down to about 6, I think 4 perhaps in the last years. And there were two things at issue. One was the style. The other was that in order to review 4 or 6 books, he probably read 30 novels. And I wasn't interested in reading 30 novels and then doing book reviews on them, particularly in this period when it became tougher and tougher to do that, because on the one hand, you had the audience, perhaps 60% or 70% non-Jewish, middle-aged, if you'll excuse me for saying this, women, who were fairly prudish. On the other hand, you had novels which left very little to the imagination. And now you were going to review these for these folks with an occasional biography or something else thrown in. Would have been a difficult task. So I decided that was something I was going to abandon. Sunday services, on the other hand, I continued till 1991, I believe, and let them slowly fade as my emphasis was on the Saturday morning service and the early Friday evening service. We tried other things too, late Friday evening, but found that was impossible to get people here to really attend in larger numbers.
So you had the best was there.
So that had started a good many years before. So decided to continue that and to work on expanding Shabbat morning and making that the main service. And then, of course, immediately introduced Bar Mitzvah, Bar and Bat Mitzvah, in a way which fitted into the service, did not dominate it as it does in most congregations, where you are, if there are two of them, you're asked, you know, whose ceremony are you attending? And if you say you're just here to worship, you get a puzzled look. So with us, it fits in, and the youngster does as much in Hebrew, really, without reading actually the service, than as tradition would demand. It's interesting. The people will occasionally say, well, the kids don't do very much. It's true. They don't read the whole service. But that, if it's done, it usually becomes inordinately painful for people who come regularly, and they soon stay away, because there are a few kids at age 13 who can read with some feeling. Most of them read with a struggle.
And the chanting is difficult.
Now, I'm not talking about the Torah. I'm talking about reading English and reading a service.